today. As Extinction Rebellion protest at London Fashion Week, we look at whether the fashion industry is really trying to be more environmentally friendly. And why are so few women nominated at tonight's Brit Awards? It's Friday night and I'm in the basement of the Savoy Hotel, backstage for a catwalk show at London Fashion Week. And I'm here with one of our Today in Focus producers, Hannah Moore. Hannah, what are you doing here?
In a really bizarre turn of events, I'm modelling in a fashion show. I've never modelled in anything before, and I really am wondering what I'm doing, because we're about to walk to this small wooden door that leads onto the Savoy's very grand ballroom where the catwalk show is happening. This was where Christian Dior held his first UK fashion show.
Oh my God, no pressure.
By the way,
looking around this room, there's a lot of people here in amazing outfits, some of them like you who aren't models, some who are, but everything you're wearing is made of recycled material. Why?
The designers here are called Vin and Omi. They're a sustainable brand, and they try to do as much as they can to create their own fabrics. Yeah, this dress is made of plastic bottles.
You look like you're in a dress covered in seashells.
You've also got this amazing finale dress made from nettles taken from Prince Charles's grounds.
Oh, wow.
Woven together with horsehair from Camilla Parker Bowles's horses.
It looks like it's made of horsehair, actually.
It really does.
It looks a bit like a woolly jumper, and a dog jumped on you and got all the hair all over you.
And the thing is that as the models walk along the catwalk in that stuff, it's going to be shedding, it's going to be kind of biodegrading, which is part of the point.
Because it's a living piece of clothing.
Yeah.
Now we're going to do with the music, you guys walking out.
We are about to go through the door, or at least you are, onto the catwalk. How are you feeling?
As if I'm walking into the complete unknown.
Good luck, Hannah. I'm going to go and see you out there.
Thanks.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus. Can the fashion industry ever be sustainable?
Get to the...
But as someone who's written about fashion and clothing for a long time, this is the inner sanctum, your wardrobe.
Yes, and I don't actually go through my wardrobe very often, so this is a horrific moment.
Okay.
This is one side of it, and then there's a door over there.
Oh, so you've got two.
Some of these pieces are like a time capsule for the sustainable fashion movement, mm-hmm. because I keep everything.
The wardrobe that I'm rifling through belongs to Lucy Siegel, who's an environmental journalist, and she's been writing about the fashion industry for over a decade. And this is like a lovely gold top. It's very silky.
Yeah, and that is from a designer who does zero waste pattern cutting.
What is zero waste pattern cutting?
So zero waste pattern cutting is part of the design process where when you cut out your pattern, you are very, very careful so that you use every scrap of fabric. And this is the jacket that they made, which is a zero waste jacket.
Which is a lovely grey blazer with these sort of kind of copper metallic pockets.
Yes, I love this. But you can see this is zero waste because if you turn it round, the back of the blazer is not a full back.
Yeah, I mean, you would say it's got a hole in it.
It has a massive hole in it because there wasn't enough fabric. So I'm going to put it on because everyone's laughing at me now.
No, it's
so
but I can see the shape is lovely. Yeah, let's see it on.
It's quite Condé Garçon.
Very Condé. Yes. It's incredibly stylish.
I mean, obviously, you've got to make sure that everything's going on properly at the back because
you don't want to give anyone else a surprise.
No, exactly. I began writing about the fashion industry in about 2005, 2006. So that's quite a long time because I knew I had a problem.
You had a problem?
I knew that I was a massive consumer of fast fashion and I knew that it was likely to be having a big impact on my carbon footprint.
Was the fashion industry talking about sustainability then?
No. So mainly the designer, Catherine Hamnett, who's very famous for slogan T-shirts in the 80s.
Choose life. That was our first T-shirt. Save the future. Save the bees.
She had done a lot of work on the cotton supply chain. For some reason, she had the foresight to think that the fabric that she was using, that her whole very successful business was predicated on, was not clean.
Its impact on the planet is ginormous.
So she started unravelling that supply chain at great cost to herself, presumably. And she'd unlocked this idea that fashion was more than just the clothes in front of you, so that there was stuff going on down the supply chain. I think for me personally, it had been some of my scientist friends who were saying things to me like, oh, you see that cardigan you're wearing? You know, it's got like 20 buttons and they're plastic and they're all made of oil. And I thought, that's really interesting. Like, I hadn't really considered the genesis of the fibre and the accessories in my wardrobe. I began to wonder how much of an impact fashion has on our personal carbon footprints. That's where I really started. And really, I found quite quickly that it seemed really big and probably coming in sort of third or second to like transport, heating your home and what you eat. Then it seemed to be fashion. And I was like, why is no one talking about this?
And as you say, that's early 2000s. No one was talking about it. And we are all and were all then huge consumers of fast fashion. And I'm just interested, as you've covered it for so long, how did fast fashion develop? How did we become such avid consumers of cheap, easy to make clothes?
Well, it's a really big story, actually, and especially for us in the UK, because we are from a textiles country. We were a massive net exporter of clothing. So really, fast fashion has started building pace since the Industrial Revolution. So the spinning jenny was a means of making cotton yarn by a machine, if you like. And as soon as cotton yarn became faster to make, fast fashion was written. It was always going to happen. So if you look in some of the literature from the 19th century, you'll find gentlemen, I use that word advisedly, writing to some of the London publications and moaning that their housemaids have no money to live on this month because they've spent it all on garments. And these were the first ready-to-wear pieces. Obviously, they weren't coming out of factories, but they were coming out of from seamstresses who were working in a production line. So the thing about fashion is that it was always going to get faster. And the thing about consumerism is that there has long been a hole in our self-worth, our psyche, whatever, however you want to describe it, which was going to be filled by a product. You give fashion space to fill and it will fill it. There are no brakes on the fashion industry unless you put them in.
I love this idea that it was almost the Victorians that came up with what is now Zara.
They would absolutely love fast fashion brands. They'd be really proud of that. They'd be as proud as that as you know, Kingdom Brunel's bridges, I think.
Before we go any further, you've talked about both here, but it would be good to distinguish the difference between what we're going to talk about today, which is sustainable fashion, and also ethical fashion.
These are very woolly terms.
Good use of woolly in this context.
Yes. Oh, yes. I hadn't even thought of that. I increasingly see people using the term sustainable fashion, meaning decarbonisation, using less water. So there's an environmental win. For me, ethical fashion means people and planet. So it's the hands behind the clothing.
How easy was it covering that in the fashion industry?
Well, when I first published my book, which is called To Die For, Is Fashion Wearing Out the World? Spoiler, yes. I encountered a lot of bemusement. So one review suggested that I was mad. And the fact that I was taking a garment, which was fun and, you know, disposable in many people's eyes and just something for a bit of a laugh, and working out how much oil had gone into production of it, just seemed like a step too far for many people. There hasn't been enough of a progression because early on, a lot of brands decided that they were part of the solution, not part of the problem. And they were allowed to cross that Rubicon without much proof. So what we've had is a whole decade where fast fashion brands have been saying, hey, we're also sustainable. We haven't had clear progression, which nobody really wants to talk about.
I do want to talk about fast fashion, but we'll get to that in a minute. A lot has been said about how damaging fashion is as an industry to the environment. But can you give me an idea of the scale?
Yeah, well, the figures are a bit disputed. And the problem is that the fast fashion brands have not been very forthcoming with their data. So we are where we are. I reckoned back in 2008, I'd sort of worked out with industry figures that we were producing about 80 billion new garments a year.
80 billion?
Yes. And from the UN charter modelling that's been done around the fashion industry, by 2050, the clothing industry could be responsible for a quarter of the entire global carbon budget. Gosh. That's not going to fly. My. This is the important thing here. Clothing production has not peaked. It is not going to peak for a while yet. And it's projected to rise by 63% by like 2040. That's another 500 billion T-shirts, ladies and gentlemen. So we need to do something about it. I'm just trying to help you help yourselves now.
And it has been said that fashion is the second most polluting or the second most damaging industry to the environment in the world. Do you think that is true?
No, I think it's top five. I wouldn't be able to say it's second.
Are there any particular fabrics that we can talk about, particular materials that are very problematic?
Well, we basically split our wardrobes between cotton and polyester, and they're both problematic. Cotton uses an extraordinary amount of water and it's grown in water-scarce areas. Polyester is from oil, so there's your link to fossil fuels. Now, the real issue is that these are made from virgin resources.
When we say virgin resources,
these are brand new resources ripped from the ground, or brand new cotton that's been grown with a huge water footprint. Because we're not able to recycle old clothes into new clothes very efficiently, then basically all of those garments are being made from new stuff. And we know that we have biodiversity problems, we have a climate crisis, and that we cannot just keep taking resources, extracting resources, and not putting anything back in.
Is it better to buy organic cotton than ordinary cotton?
Yes, absolutely. It's better to buy organic cotton because the carbon footprint of that garment is going to be substantially less. It is unfortunate if all the organic cotton is bought up by massive chains where it only accounts for a tiny part of their inventory. And actually what their main goal in life is to produce huge amounts of inventory in polyester, which they have no plan for how they're going to get that back.
A lot of high street shops now, Zara, H&M, have launched conscious ranges.
Cares for water, cares for fibre, and closing the loop to protect life.
Fashion can become a part of the solution. H&M Conscious Exclusive.
Can I feel better about myself for buying from them?
Don't let the fact that it's from a conscious range overrule all the other stuff that you should be putting in place. So, do I need this? Is there a space in my wardrobe for it? My very simple 30 wears rule. Will I wear it 30 times and do I know that right now at this minute? So all of those things are more important than what it's made from. It's also worth having a look if it's a better quality fibre, which sometimes these ranges can be because the brands have used them as a little bit of a loss leader sometimes.
Do you think we're seeing a positive shift towards change in the industry and in fast fashion in general?
I really do, because I think the penny is dropping that the fast fashion brands are not going to save us and that the industry is not going to come and save us. You know, the £1 bikini.
Yeah, so on a Monday, they launched a black bikini, which was £1. But yeah, this is sick. If this comes back in stock or becomes like a regular thing, get your hands on it.
You know, I did a lot of stuff around this and I looked at it under a microscope and I looked at the plastic content and I compared it to a wet wipe. And the wet wipe is better.
So you'd be better off wearing a wet wipe?
Yes, I mean, in terms of like construction, I don't approve of wet wipes, by the way, and please don't flush them because...
That's a disclosure, don't use wet wipes.
Don't use wet wipes. Yeah.
You've argued in the past that London Fashion Week is a big problem and you supported Extinction Rebellion's call for it to come to an end. And in September, they staged a funeral for the industry outside the shows.
We must act now.
Extinction Rebellion activists at London Fashion Week, gluing themselves to the entrance of a venue protesting the industry's impact on climate change.
We've proved that disruption does work, and so we'll continue to do that until everyone, all industries, not just the fashion industry, get on board and start, you know, acting accordingly to this climate and ecological emergency.
And you signed a letter of support. Why was that?
I felt that it needed a massive wake-up call, and I felt that the British Fashion Council and London Fashion Week hadn't shown any willingness to support the climate emergency in a meaningful way. At the moment, we have a Fashion Week, and this is not exclusive to London. I mean, so it's the same
it's
in
New York,
Paris. It's
a global issue.
Yeah, man, it's a global issue, where Fashion Weeks are not operating as if we're in a climate emergency. I think what they're really asking for is something that like has happened in Sweden. So Stockholm Fashion Week was called off because the organisers said they needed to recalibrate the whole thing.
Because they're just promoting opulence often and just designing more and more new clothing.
Yeah, it's promoting essentially more stuff, much of which is made in the same way that's caused the problem that's got us to this point in the first place.
There are some designers who are trying to make a difference and are certainly trying to be innovative when it comes to making clothing that is better for the planet. I mean, we were at the Vinonomi show on Friday. They're making clothes out of nettles, recycled plastic.
Well, Vinonomi I really, really like. So I was at a conference in Costa Rica and there was somebody there wearing one of their sweatshirts which said, "Stop fucking the planet." And I thought, this is great. What an absolute message. Yes, thank you. In the last sort of 5 to 10 years, we've seen that promise of sustainable action and sexy design coming together, like having your cake and eating it. So, you know, there's been the sustainable angle, which is the sort of expo for new fibres and innovation happened in London recently. And there was all sorts of kind of crazy, cool things. There was nettle fibres, which is not new at all. They've been using them in Nepal for, you know, over 1,000 years. We also have Modern Meadows in New York.
At Modern Meadow, we're looking to take the building blocks of nature to create a whole new range of biologically advanced materials.
Which has been able to isolate collagen in leather so that they can grow leather without a cow, which is very, very clever. So there's a sort of split between regenerative fibers, which are things like linen and flax, which take in carbon and lock it into the soil as they grow. So they're carbon neutral.
So linen is a good fabric because it's almost carbon capturing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, sort of, yes. But also nutrient capturing. So unlike cotton, where a lot of agrochemicals are used to produce the global cotton crop, linen and flax and those kind of fibers have been shown to lock that in and be beneficial to the soils when they're grown properly. So that's very promising. And there's a whole sort of fiber shed movement looking at using those models. And another thing that's interesting about and the fiber shed movement is they're looking at using local fibers for local production. So you could conceivably at some point buy a shirt that's made of like a linen that's sequestered carbon. And at the end of its life, you could drop it back into the soil and it would biodegrade.
Oh, I'm excited by a future where I might plant my shirt in the garden.
There you go. But this is a serious point with anything compostable or biodegradable. So many years ago, I was sent out in a skirt and a top for the Observer newspaper to road test these garments, which were made of Injeo, which is a cornstarch fabric, which was biodegradable. And I was very worried because it's a hot day that they were going to start degrading on the tube. Actually, they didn't. They were fine. A little bit stiff.
I'm sort of imagining you in kind of like a tortilla wrap. On the cheese.
Felt like a tortilla wrap. Probably the photos are in your archive if you're really interested in this.
If you get hungry, can you eat it?
Yeah.
You see, the work that designers like Vinonomi are doing is incredibly exciting, but is the truth. You know, they are a business who they don't actually sell any of the clothes that they make. The clothes being seen at these runway shows, these innovative styles, are not something that are going to be accessible or ever available to us at a price that we can afford.
Well, that's really sad, isn't it? Because if you think about all this energy and this effort for something that people are not going to get access to, that's absolutely ridiculous. But the trouble is that we've always said, how do we mainstream this? And the idea has always been we emulate fast fashion and just make it out of organic cotton. But then it's not sustainable and it's not ethical because the business model's the same, the idea's the same, everything remains the same. So we need to do a better job at messaging what's great about not being locked into fast fashion consumption.
So are you saying that being sustainable is not also about making profit?
Well, you might look to make your profit in different ways, but it can't be to just be pushing out ever-increasing amounts of clothing made of plastic onto the world and then kicking the can down the road by saying, oh, we're going to get better at recycling it.
Sustainable fashion may not feel accessible to everybody, but what can we all be doing to help?
Okay, so take shopping apps off your phone. Even if you do it for a month or 2 months, give yourself a break so you're not constantly bombarded with imagery about what you should be wearing and what you should look like. If you are still shopping, make sure there's a genuine place in your wardrobe for that garment and it's going to be in service for a really long time. And have a look at buying secondhand. Especially if you're one of the 51% who hasn't bought anything secondhand in the last year, this is now time to start.
And is that charity shops or where else can people look for secondhand clothing, do you think?
There are other avenues that are very, very interesting. I think Depop's really interesting.
I'm a huge fan of Depop, but for people who are listening, you might not know.
Well, Depop is a marketplace, essentially, for buying and selling secondhand clothing. And it does it very well with younger people in particular. So 90s sportswear is a really big thing, which is quite freaky for me.
Sustainable fashion for all of us then is not about buying clothes made of hemp. It's just about buying less clothes.
It's about buying, renting, sharing, owning, swapping, repairing clothes that work for you.
Lucy, thank you very much for speaking to me and for letting me into your wardrobe.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Lucy has written about this for The Guardian and you can find her work on the website, where you can also read Hannah's article about walking and not falling over in the Vin & Omi fashion show. Coming up, is one of the UK's biggest music awards failing to recognise women? Now, tonight marks 40 years of the Brit Awards, one of the UK's most high-profile music industry events. With less than a handful of women and non-binary artists receiving nominations, for The Guardian's deputy music editor Laura Snapes, industry change is long overdue.
So here we are again. It's the Brit Awards tonight, and as ever for the past couple of years, there's a dire lack of female nominees. Across 25 potential slots for recognition in mixed gender categories, only one female artist was nominated, that was Mabel. We should also recognise Sam Smith, a non-binary artist who was up there for their single with Normani. But yeah, apart from that, dire across the board. The explanation that the Brits has given for this is that the eligibility list is only based on what's in the charts. To me, this is like them passing the buck from left hand to right, because the Brits is run by major labels. They each take a turn every 3 years to be in charge of it, and major labels release what's going in the chart. So essentially, they are blaming themselves. They're not putting out enough music by women. In 2016, there was the Brit So White controversy, in a year where grime had really broken through as a commercial force. Absolutely no grime artists or black artists were nominated whatsoever. That has changed, which is really encouraging, but it's primarily benefiting male acts because it's male rappers who are breaking through in those industries. Female talent is not getting recognised at the same level. Personally, I find it really confusing as to why this is happening, because the British music industry is not incapable of breaking female acts. Adele is the biggest success of the 21st century. When you go back 10 years, you've got artists like Florence and the Machine and Lily Allen, and although these are very white artists, they are coming at pop from very different perspectives. It's not like something we're incapable of doing. But over the past few years, a strain of conservatism has popped up around female artists, as the biggest British stars have primarily become sad white blokes in hats with beards. There's apparently been a kind of a disincentivization for record labels to sign female acts because styling is more expensive and that kind of thing. And then the ones that have broken through, they all tend to be kind of within the same mould. Dua Lipa was the last big success. And you can see Dua Lipa now being held up as a figurehead that other female acts are being pushed into. They'll spend a few years on the training wheels doing guest vocal slots with big producers. And then if some of those break big enough, then they get the chance to make their version. And it's this horrible, repetitive treadmill. And it fails me why the British music industry has become so conservative. Because when you look to America, Ariana Grande, Lizzo, Billie Eilish, they're the biggest stars of the past few years, and they are iconoclastic women who are getting to make the music that they want, not just focus group dance pop. The British music industry is still really male-dominated. What we need is more women in positions of power in the industry at songwriting level to help push different subjects and different kind of expressions of creativity. I think that would really trickle down to there being greater opportunity for a greater diversity of female artists to break through again. We need to support specialised female talents in every area of the industry. I think that festival billings have a really important role to play in this as well. Just last week, I saw Matt Healy from the 1975 saying that he thought that Rage Against the Machine were really great headliners for Reading and Leeds 2020. And I replied to him and I said they would be great headliners if they actually use their power to support gender equality at festivals and to demand it, because I think that's the only way it's going to happen. And in response, he said that in the future, he would only play festivals that are committed to that kind of thing. My mentions have been a mess since, with blokes, you know, complaining about quotas and how it's the killer of creativity and blah, blah, blah. But it's not at all. It will encourage greater creativity, because if record labels know that there are those slots to fill at high profile events where you're reaching young consumers, because that's all it's about, really, is money, they will find that talent and they'll fill those slots because it's an opportunity for them.
That was Laura Snapes. Thank you to her and Lucy Siegel. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.